Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 8th of January. This show, and I'm so glad you suggested it, it's going to be a good hour, was suggested by a couple listeners, actually, on our open line on Monday, was it, or on Tuesday. It's the author of a piece in Mother Jones, the January-February issue, Fiscal Therapy, Getting the Economy Back on Its Feet, Giving Taxpayers a Break, Saving Your Retirement Fund and Your Kids' College Tuition, done, and it won't cost you a penny. Our guest is David K. Johnson. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and he is the author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense. he looks at ways that we can take from those programs and very, very change the tax code, et cetera, look at some companies that are just committing highway robbery and return to this nation's reason for existence, really, which can be reduced, he says, to six principles: society, justice, peace, security, commonwealth, and freedom. Individual riches do not make the list. They are a product of American society and not a guiding purpose. And we need to look at a whole range of issues that maybe you never even knew about some of these before. I didn't realize how bad it was until reading this. And so we're going to look at how it is that this trickle-down approach has really failed to deliver, that we've been, as he says, slowly impoverishing ourselves. Incomes at the very top have soared to levels beyond imagination, even a generation ago. But the average inflation-adjusted income of the bottom 90% of the earners was lower in 2006 than it was back in 1973. We're going to get a ton of phone calls on this issue, I'm sure. Join us if you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hello, David. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, Kathleen, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, sure. It just ain't fair, is it, David?
Well, life isn't fair, but one of the points of a democracy is that but we should all be trying to set up those rules that help our society endure. And unfortunately, in this country, we have been sold for a number of years a bill of goods, and we now have 30 years of experience that tell us that the policies we have been pursuing simply don't work.
And tell me, we hear this, but tell me specifically how this is manifesting itself. Incomes at the very top have soared to levels beyond imagination, while those of us who are in the bottom 90% inflation-adjusted income worse than it was in 1973. How did that happen? Through government deregulation or changes in laws? And how did we let that happen?
Well, it absolutely is the result of official actions taken by the government. When I started looking at this stuff back in 1995, I had no idea I would end up finding in the official government records the kind of material that I write about in Free Lunch and in the article in Mother Jones. But what we've done is created a society in which we redistribute income and wealth upward. The marginal tax rate of a police officer, a firefighter, a typical office worker in the United States today is more than 40%, 25% income tax rate, and then 15% payroll tax.
Wow.
The marginal tax rate of the highest earning Americans, and there were three people in 2007 who we know each made $3 billion of income in a single year. $3 billion, not wealth, but income. Mm-hmm. Their marginal tax rate was either 15% or zero.
Oh, my gosh.
It was zero if they chose to defer receiving that money and not being taxed on it. Now, that's absurd. And what we have done in this country is created a system in which the very, very top, the top one-tenth of 1%, now that's just 300,000 men, women, and children, have almost as much income as the bottom 150 million
Americans. Isn't that incredible? That is just incredible. And you talk about the fact, and we don't think about this, that those tax deferrals that you just mentioned are one of the major tools for redistributing the wealth upward.
That's right. If you could imagine, you got a deal that Warren Buffett has, because I write about him in Free Lunch. Warren Buffett has an interest-free loan from the taxpayers for two-thirds of $1 billion, and he has to pay half of it back 31 years from now. Now let's go back in time. Imagine you bought a house in 1978, 31 years ago. You'd lived in it all these years. You made no payments on the mortgage. And this year, you had to pay half the number of dollars that you agreed to back in 1978 without regard to inflation. You think that deal alone, Kathleen, would make you very comfortable financially?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we've been doing. We have all these mechanisms. The reason the tax code is so enormously long, it's not about you and me. It's about all the provisions that are put in that allow corporations and very wealthy individuals to either never pay a tax or pay the tax so far into the future that it's an irrelevancy.
Mm-hmm. And if we, as you suggest, stopping all the tax deferrals beyond the modest amounts allowed for retirement savings, the amount of money the federal government could gain is astronomical.
Yes. Now, we don't know how much it is because the government doesn't collect this data. One of the things I spent several years working on free lunch and hired a staff of people to work for me on the book. To dig out stuff is I can tell you exactly how much the government spends on things like taking care of orphans. The government collects that data, how much it spends on care for the disabled. But it doesn't tell you how much there is in tax giveaways to Walmart and Lowe's and Target and Home Depot and all the big national retailers that are creating stores where when you walk into these stores when they're new, the sales taxes that you pay at the cash register, in many cases, legally, are kept by the owners of the store. They do not go to the government. The store owners keep those taxes, and they use them to pay the costs of building the store. Now, these deals are done under the guise that they create jobs. Well, if I create a subsidized retail store, there certainly will be jobs at that location. But unless the economy grows or the population grows, there is no growth in the total retail jobs. And what that really means is that government is destroying the jobs at entrepreneurially owned retail stores, local owned retail stores, or alternatively, it's destroying jobs at other chains that aren't getting the same deal. But in any event, it is concentrating the jobs and the economic gains at the businesses that get these politically favored gifts of taxpayer money. And it is billions and billions of dollars.
Yeah.
And
then you also go a step further. That results in a direct hit on the money available for schools, on the money available for police and parks, et cetera.
That's exactly right. And these sales tax dollars, since there's no real growth going on, it's argued that, well, these are additional sales tax dollars, so it doesn't matter if the public doesn't get them. Well, there are additional sales tax dollars, and the data show this. And so that means that these public services are starved for money, or alternatively, you and I have to pay more in taxes somewhere else to make up for the losses. And, you know, one of the questions to ask yourself is, why would we subsidize a retail store? Retail is the end of the economic chain, not the beginning. It makes sense to subsidize basic research for which there may be no direct economic return to the researchers. It makes sense to subsidize infrastructure because you need to move goods and services around the country. You need to have clean water to have a healthy population. But why would you subsidize retail? That's the end of the economic chain. And yet that we're pouring a fortune into subsidizing retail.
Well, why are we?
Well, what happens is, why would the local city fathers of some small town vote to give a subsidy to Walmart or Cabela's or Target against the interests of their local owners? Well, first of all, in many cases, having interviewed local city fathers about this, they don't understand what they're doing. But those who do, their attitude is, well, they're going to build this new store, and if we don't give them this deal here in town, they're going to go to the next town over. They'll build it there.
Right.
They'll destroy our locally owned stores, and we won't have these jobs either.
So what's the answer to that? What would happen to these big stores like Walmart, Target, et cetera, if sales taxes were not going into the building of the building?
Well, they might, in the long run, still dominate the economy if they're more efficient operators. But they're not competing in a market capitalist system. Mm. They're competing in a system of corporate socialism that favors those firms that get these deals. Mm-hmm. So they might, at the end of the day, if they're more efficient, prevail. But they absolutely will prevail if they get these subsidies from a government.
There's a term we don't hear very often, corporate socialism.
Well, America is just thoroughly riddled with it. We have created all sorts of mechanisms that essentially provide government protections and guarantees for large companies and put the risks of the market on you and me. And we've seen this in the bailout that's gone on here at the end of the Bush administration. The Bush administration has put out, by, I think, the best measures that have been done of it, more than $8 trillion of either spending or guarantees. How much is $8 trillion? Well, it's all of the individual income taxes paid by all Americans for the entire Bush administration, and then you're still $1 trillion short. And this is just a massive giveaway, redistribution of income to those at the very top through government policy. Instead of letting businesses fail, because in a capitalist system, businesses fail, we've taken these very large businesses, we've allowed them to operate in ways that are not economically sound, and then we're propping them up.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at, before we have a ton of phone calls coming in, I want to go to them shortly, David. This one, though, knocked me out. I read it to my family last night. We have a lot of people listening in the university community, education community. Over the past 40 years, you write, the cost of public colleges has doubled. Financing tuition is an $85 billion a year business. And students who sign up for loans with Sallie Mae, the biggest of the private student loan companies, earns an average 48% annual return. I need to say that again. 48% annual return, three times the return of commercial banks. That's phenomenal.
And it's because of government rules. Ooh. You sign a Sallie Mae loan that you think is at 6.8% interest. Well, here's what happens. You leave college, and if you were graduating from college in December, you've gone into a job market where there may be no jobs to be had. If you miss a payment, they get to rewrite your loan and jack up your interest rate to 18%. I've talked to a few people who've had even higher rates than that with some other lenders that are in this federal program. This repayment is required by law. You know, you take out a loan from a bank, if it's a credit card loan and you don't repay it, the bank ultimately suffers a loss. And so the bank has an interest, a market interest, in only loaning to those people who are reliably going to pay the money back. Well, the student loan doesn't work that way. There are only three ways to get rid of a student loan. You have to pay it back in full under the terms that were agreed to, including the fine print that no student I've interviewed yet actually has read. You have to prove that you're totally, permanently, and 100% disabled and unable to work. And just because Social Security and the state says you are doesn't mean that the Sallie Mae company will say you are. Or you have to die with no assets. Mm. And I have interviewed students who took out $30,000 in loans who now have $100,000 balances. Some of the loan companies, if you miss one payment in the 20-year repayment period, all remaining payments are deemed to be late, and you pay a $29 a month late fee for every loan payment for the rest of the loan.
Mm. And what does that do for, you know, a student who goes into the workforce who has to pay back these loans, too? You talk about indenturing bright young minds.
That's exactly right. And what, you know, it used to be that we treated investment in higher education as a public investment in the future of the country. Instead, we have, as with many other things, turned to this notion that it's a business and that we should be profiting off of young minds. Well, the most valuable asset we have in America isn't iron ore in the ground or the amount of water we have. It's the gray matter between young ears that needs to be structured and given rigorous skills to make us as a society wealthier, healthier, and to continue our freedoms.
We're going to go to phone calls. We have tons of them coming in. David K. Johnson is our guest. Our attention was drawn via listeners on our open line to the January-February issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Well worth the read. His article titled Fiscal Therapy. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He's a his former beat for some 14 years, tax reporter for the New York Times. And he also serves now as a columnist for the trade journal Tax Notes. Our number, 800-486-8655, to you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, and let's start with Rick. Rick, you're on the air. Hi.
Well, good morning. I've read your guest's book, and there seems to be an implication in there. I think that it's conservatives that are responsible for this, but I'd like to just mention how both parties have contributed. Milton Friedman, professor of economics from University of Chicago with a Nobel Prize in economics, he stated that before the last time the Clinton administration increased taxes on the middle class, that we were already paying approximately 43% of our income in taxes. And then on top of that, Hillary in the Senate, she voted for that bill that says that it's almost impossible to declare bankruptcy if you have outstanding credit card balances. And the way we're funding this bailout, or talking about it, you know, with these $700, $800, even $1 trillion deficits, that money is going to have to be paid back sometime in the future. And that's going to put the tax percentage for ordinary people, I don't know, up to 50% or 60%, just like it is in Sweden, and we aren't going to get any more government in exchange for it. We're just going to be paying this off.
David.
Well, Rick, first of all, Rick is exactly right. This is not about the Republicans and Democrats. This is a bipartisan problem in Washington. It's one of the principal points I make in the book. And real conservatives, as opposed to the corporatists who call themselves conservatives or the news media calls conservatives, are not the problem here. It is the corporatist class that is at the core of this problem, because large companies have figured out that it's much easier to make money by mining the government treasury than it is to earn in the marketplace. And by the way, little point about Sweden. You know, the Swedes have the highest taxes in the world. They pay 51% of their economy is taxes. I spent 6 weeks in Europe and Canada this year doing research and interviewing ordinary people I met on the streets and wherever about their incomes. In Stockholm, I walked up to a dozen bus drivers who were waiting for the tourists. It turned out every one of these bus drivers owned two houses, and they owned them free and clear. One was a city house, or more likely apartment, and the other was a country place. Now, the country places ranged from a glorified fishing shack with an outhouse to a full-blown house with 8 rooms that the extended family stayed at. And I said to one of the bus drivers, well, how do you guys afford the mortgages on a bus driver's salary? And they all sort of smiled at me, and then they explained that they owned them free and clear. What are the odds in the U.S. you could find a dozen bus drivers at a street corner who owned a single house free and clear? Right. It isn't the level of taxes that's so important as how the government spends the money. We are spending our money principally on repaying debts from the past, and military, and on income transfers to corporations and the very wealthy. The Swedes spend their tax dollars greasing the wheels of commerce and removing shocks from life for ordinary citizens.
That's an interesting way to put it. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Laverne from Monroe. Hi, Laverne.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Dave. It's an honor to talk to you.
Well, likewise.
I read two of your books. And you ought to testify in front of Congress. You heard of Bernard Madoff?
Yes.
Hedge fund dealer? Now,
right.
I understand he hides his money offshore in a lot of other places. What do you think of President-elect Obama? He said he wants to tax those offshore hedge fund dealers. We certainly need the revenue. Why wouldn't it be a good idea to go after those offshore guys?
Well, Laverne, in the article in Mother Jones, the last segment is called Invade the Cayman.
Right.
And well, I'm sort of only semi-serious about it. The Cayman Islands is, in a little strip in the middle of the Caribbean, is the fifth largest banking center in the world. Roughly a quarter of all corporate profits, are U.S. corporate profits, are now being taken in tax havens so they don't pay taxes on them. I think that this is so much money, and it is, by the best measure, at least 2.5 times what it was in 1990, that we need to take serious action against these tax havens. These are little parasitic operations that make money by helping wealthy people and large corporations hide their money. And, you know, the very same techniques that are used by people to evade taxes are the same techniques that were used by Osama bin Laden to fund the attack on the United States. They are the same things being used by the narco traffickers. And I can't find a moral argument for cheating on your taxes. If you don't like your taxes, we live in a democracy. Elect a different Congress. But the notion that we impose serious, heavy sanctions, sometimes 10-year penalties on single mothers over mistakes in the earned income tax credit, and yet we look the other way at billionaires who stash untaxed dollars offshore and hide them not only from the IRS, but often from investors, business partners, or spouses in divorces, is absurd.
And as you suggest in the article, to introduce a note of levity, perhaps, since the Grand Cayman Islands nation's total armed forces consists of about 300 police officers, it shouldn't be hard for technicians and auditors, accompanied by a few Marines, to fly in and seize all the records.
Shouldn't be difficult at all. I figure it'd take a few hundred Marines and a few thousand auditors and technicians.
Right, a few thousand, right. Thank you, Laverne. I think you were one who suggested this show. Thank you very much for the suggestion as well. Let's go to Mike from Milwaukee next. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I have a couple quick things before my question. Number one, to raise money for Wisconsin Public Radio, I think you should sell T-shirts with Laverne's name on it, Laverne Call Home, or something like that. I think it would be a good fundraising. Everybody knows Laverne. And then number two, I think listening to a couple shows on journalism, it's frightening to think that as money shrinks up for publications that we might miss out on excellent journalism like this. And then my question is, you know, I always hear on right-wing talk show hosts and even right-wing economists who might know better, they say that if you tax corporations, all they're going to do is pass the that tax down to the consumer, and we're going to land up paying for it. For some reason, that doesn't seem right. I think Krugman might have said something to the effect that it's not passed down to the consumer, but to the shareholder. But how does that work? That if you do tax them and they do pay for fire service and police service and so on and so forth, how is that not passed down to the consumer?
Well, in a competitive market, Mike, different companies will have different tax obligations depending on their design, their life cycle structure, et cetera. So if the market is really competitive, they can't just pass that cost on. They have to absorb it largely. The ways you can do it are it either reduces the earnings of the owners, which tends to be the major effect. It may result in lower wages for the workers or lower prices to vendors. The tax has to be paid by someone, but you can't just say, oh, it means higher prices to consumers. That's absolute nonsense. One of the things that I recommend in the Mother Jones piece and in Free Lunch is that we end this system of having corporations keep two sets of books, one for shareholders and one for the IRS. Many companies that report to shareholders that they pay billions of dollars in taxes, in fact, make money off the tax system. Over in your neighboring state of Minnesota, I wrote when I was still at the New York Times about how the big electric utility there, Xcel, had found a way to pocket hundreds of millions of dollars of taxes people had paid in their electric rates, because being monopoly, you have to pay all their costs. That case does apply to the pass-through. And there are lots of criticisms of the corporate income tax. One of the things I've been arguing and arguing Free Lunch is we have a well-designed tax system for the 20th century. we don't have a well-designed tax system for the 21st century, and we need to have a national debate about how do we tax, keeping in mind the principle of tax policy that gave birth to democracy 2,500 years ago. The way we got democracy was through tax policy. The Athenians figured out that without civilization, without government, there is no wealth. Therefore, the greater the wealth you are able to build, the greater your moral duty to pay back to the government through your taxes so that you and others can continue to enjoy those benefits. Mm-hmm. This principle, progressive taxation, has been lost because we've had politicians for 30 years treat taxes not as part of a social compact so that we have a society, but instead as just a cost of doing business that you want to try and eliminate.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Frank from Madison next. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
As usual, but you have a fine guest, but you have an extraordinarily fine guest today. I hate to say this, but I've heard this before in much more elevated language. Adam Smith argued for free markets and against fixed government where entrepreneurs seek rents. And this is in the Wealth of Nations, and he argued for regulation. And you don't hear this in the common discourse, especially in Washington or New York. And so I'm really happy to hear your guests say these things. And it's worth noting that people like Paul Volcker may have read Adam Smith for the first time because he has noted that he found an argument for regulation of banks in the Wealth of Nations.
Well, Frank, I hope you read Free Lunch because the opening story in Free Lunch is about Adam Smith. I rely on him throughout my book. I've read every word the man wrote at least twice. And I show how a businessman who was not seeking a subsidy, a guy who's a libertarian, started a business that is phenomenally profitable and connect it to Adam Smith.
Hmm. Yes. The theory of moral sentiments is also never evoked. And then
yes,
finally,
that's a very important book by Adam
I always remember when I hear these arguments against taxation and that the rich are particularly virtuous, and this is why they shouldn't be taxed, is that the British lost their colonies when they tried to tax them. Tax collectors were hung from trees when they tried to tax an Englishman's cider. And when they were faced with the need to defeat the French, they went where the money was and taxed the rich. So if you're the moral equivalent of defeating the French, I think there are many other things that we could use proper taxation for. So you take care.
Thank you, Frank. Thanks for teaching us, as you always do. I enjoy your calls. Thanks for your call. Let's go next to Joe is next from Wausau. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I hear you, and I agree with you, but it's taken 30 years to get this deep, even all the new politicians that we've elected don't seem to want to touch this and seem to still be in corporate pockets. So my question is, how on earth do we fix this?
That's Joe, that's a really good question. In the new paperback version of Free Lunch at the end, I have a discussion about how to do this. The fundamental problem we have is a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Buckley. And that decision basically says dollars are free speech. Well, if dollars are free speech in campaigns, then the wealthy, and particularly those among the wealthy who want to abuse the government for their own benefit, are going to have a disproportionate voice. And so we have to find a way around that. And I suggest a number of steps in the paperback edition of Free Lunch of how we can do this, starting with let's stop failing to pay the real costs of Congress. Let's stop trying to get a free lunch where we have lobbyists providing, 35,000 lobbyists now in Washington for 535 congressmen. Let's stop allowing these guys to take trips, meals, et cetera. let's pay the real expenses of Congress, make a complete disclosure of the records, and if you take a shot of whiskey from a lobbyist, you go to prison.
Whew. Can you say that again? Did I hear you right? 35,000 lobbyists.
Twice the number there were in the year 2000.
Oh, my goodness.
That should be telling you what is the growth industry in America.
Right.
It is sucking money out of the government treasury. And, you know, Ronald Reagan, when he ran for office, Kathleen, was always going around saying that democracy can't last 200 years because eventually the rabble will figure out they can vote themselves the largesse of the public treasury. Well, he was partly right. But it's the elites, not all of them, but those among the elites who are unprincipled, who figured out that they can increase their riches by getting money from the public treasury. And it is unbelievable how much they're getting. You know, remember, you live in a state, Wisconsin, where they were going to get rid of all the corporate auditors, even though they bring in a lot of money to the state to save money. So we're going to save a few hundred thousand of dollars in salaries and not collect millions and millions of dollars of taxes.
Hmm. We'll get on that. The problem is there's so many things to get on, aren't there? Thanks very much, Joe, for your call. 800-486-8655 is our number, and let us go to Randolph from Madison. Hi, Randolph.
Yeah, what I don't hear brought up in this discussion is something I've been thinking about for a long time, and that recently I found quite a movement going on through the Internet that addresses a problem of what's called first mover problem of in our current economic system or governmental system, especially the global capitalistic system, that it pressures companies to do what they do, because if they don't expand or do these type of tax write-offs or other things that other companies will. And it's a global problem now where if you're not the first move, if you become the first move and you try to do the right thing, you become not competitive is what the theory is. And the thing that I found on the Internet is a movement called Simultaneous Policy, and I wonder if you've ever heard of that, John Bunzel, where it's a movement to work with governments, especially internationally, to create a system where politicians get elected that will pledge to work together to address these problems because they can't be done otherwise.
Well, Randolph, I know John Bunzel a little bit, and I'm vaguely familiar with this, but not enough to really comment about it.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. One of the focuses in your article, and I hate these places. I don't understand why they still exist. And that's defang the loan sharks. You talk about, and I had no idea the interest rates were this high. You talk about Different Strokes, Gary Coleman pitching loans at 99.25% interest?
Yep.
Ah.
Yep. In fact, some of the loans people take out for tax in anticipation of their income tax refund can have an infinite rate of interest, but it's very easy for the actual rate of interest to be 1,500% on an annualized basis because the loan lasts basically one day in terms of repayment.
Mm. How can they exist, David? This seems so wrong to so many people.
Well, in 1978, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a case called Marquette, was faced with a conflict between state and federal banking law, and under the Primacy Clause of the Constitution said the federal law had to prevail. And in doing so, it effectively then repealed or vitiated all the usury laws in all across the country. And the Supreme Court said to Congress, explicitly said to Congress, this is a major problem. You need to address this. Well, what Congress did is they milked it for campaign contributions.
Mm.
Millions and millions and millions of dollars of campaign contributions. Mm. They've never fixed the system. So we end up now with this situation where I used to know a loan shark who I wrote about years ago as a reporter, who went to prison for charging people 2 points a week. That's 104% simple interest. And I wish he were alive, because I'd love to ask him about Gary Coleman,
right,
making 99.25% interest rate loans. This is a problem Congress has not addressed, and the fact that it hasn't goes right to the heart of the influence of campaign money. You look at how deeply Americans are in debt instead of saving. You know, that's one of the areas where, despite their high taxes, the Swedes aren't in debt like we are. They have debt, but not like we do. And the Western Europeans, the folks in the Netherlands, in Norway, in Denmark, they're not in debt like we are, because they have government policies and rules that don't allow these systems to arise.
So if you go to college, or if you happen to be poor and pressed for money, you're always going to be in debt, right?
Yes. And one of the things I've often thought about is, when I went to college, my dad was 100% disabled veteran of World War II. And I had to go to work when I was 10 years old and full-time when I was 13. And the only reason that I was able to go to college was that college was free and I happened to get some war orphan benefits. Well, today I know and have found many young people who got good grades who are not going to college because there's no money. I had a New York State senator say to me, well, it only costs $9,000 a year to go to state college. And I said, well, what do you think the average income of the bottom 50% of Americans is? And he had no idea. It's about $30,000. How does a family on $30,000 send a kid to school at a cost of 10?
Right.
This is insane.
Right.
And what we're doing here is the functional equivalent of an agrarian society eating its seed corn.
Yeah.
We are taking the most valuable asset we have, young minds, and not investing in them. And in the long run, it will make America much poorer.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is David K. Johnson. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His book in paperback is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. And we also draw your attention to an issue in the article in the current issue of Mother Jones, the January-February issue, which is worth your read, Fiscal Therapy. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll take more of your phone calls in a moment. I should say also that David is a columnist now for the Trade Journal Tax Notes and was a tax reporter for the New York Times for a number of years. More calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to your phone calls now. Chris from Glendale is our next caller. Hi, Chris.
20 years ago, I read a book critical of multinational corporations, and there was a word in there I did not understand, and the word was transfer payment. Could you please define what a transfer payment is?
I'd be delighted. Transfer payments are one of the biggest abuses of the tax system. Imagine you're in the business of building tennis shoes. You build them in Vietnam, and your cost of making that pair of tennis shoes, FOB, which is freight on board, that is when you put them on a ship in the harbor, is $1 a pair. By the way, that's about what they cost to actually make, $1 a pair. While the ship is on its way to the United States, you sell those tennis shoes to your Cayman Islands corporation. You transfer the price. And let's say you charge, the Cayman Islands company pays $50 for those shoes. Then you sell them back to your American distribution company. This is all still within your own operation, just subordinate units of your company, for $60. And then you sell them to the retail store for $65, and they then price them at $130.
Oh,
Keystone, the double the market. You notice where they took all the profits? They took them in the Cayman Islands and don't pay any taxes. Transfer pricing. And this is a system that is opaque. It's based on agreements. We know from some limited information that some companies have made deals where they made out like bandits, and other companies made deals that weren't nearly so good. But it is the fundamental way that multinational corporations abuse tax systems.
Mm.
Is this something done by companies that we're all familiar with, meaning prominent brand name consumer goods?
Every one of them. You know, Nike makes shoes. General Motors make cars. The drug companies do this. It's done by every one of the multinational companies that you buy stuff from every time you're out buying things. And it is a worldwide common practice And when an effort is made to address this, you will immediately hear, you know, the touts, the cable TV shows that tout stocks and give you sort of a very spin story about all this, about how terrible that the government is interfering with business practices. But the only purpose of transfer pricing, the only purpose of that sale to the Cayman Islands subsidiary, is to avoid taxes, and I would argue to evade the tax.
Is there any legitimate function? Is there a way to do transfer payments that's respectable, or is it inherently deceptive?
Well, I hate to be absolutist on the first one, so there probably are, in fact, there are some minor arguments to be made about this, although in their internal transfers, I don't see any benefit whatsoever. But it seems to me that we should simply try to have a system that is transparent. I mean, why did Bernie Madoff get away with what he got? Because he wasn't transparent. Almost every accounting fraud I have written about in my career over the last 40 years has stemmed from lack of transparency. Sunlight is still the best disinfectant, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, what, about 100 years ago now.
Hmm. So do you feel, how do you feel 20 years asking this question for 20 years? Does it make you more worried now, Chris?
Well, what I'm familiar with is television network economics, and there was a certain kind of self-dealing going on among TV networks when their network operations were charged to their local affiliates that they owned. They don't own all of their affiliates. And what this did was shrink the pie that would later be cut up between affiliates they don't own and the network. And this was part of one of the rare investigations of television network behavior. And I never really found a universal term for all of this. All I can call it is self-dealing.
Mm-hmm.
And the manifestation in television network economics it doesn't seem to be too peculiar to that field. It seems to be something that could go on in lots of organizations.
And indeed it does. For example, let me take Walmart as an example of this. The name Walmart is owned by an entity in, I think it's Delaware. Every Walmart store pays that entity in Delaware a fee for having a sign out front that says Walmart. That reduces the taxes that the company owes on the profits it makes in, say, Wisconsin, and sends them to Delaware where they're not taxed.
Uh-huh.
It's just a tax avoidance device.
Huh.
We don't have to allow these things, but they are proliferating like mad as ways to escape taxation and shift the burden of taxes off of corporations and the very well-to-do and on to people down below, violating the Athenian principle I mentioned earlier.
Right. Thanks very much for your call, Chris. Let's go next to Jenny from Milwaukee. Hi, Jenny.
Is it me?
Oh, Janine?
Janine, yeah.
Hi, Janine.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Kathleen.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a joy. I have so many questions, but one of the things I wanted to say is I have this little fantasy that we somehow get in place an algorithm, a software that this is basically run through. Everything involving where our money goes is run through, and it is transparent, and we know where it goes. And it's interesting that you were talking about the Caymans. I'm also very interested in what you think of Dubai.
Well, Dubai, you know, has now become the headquarters of Halliburton, and I think you're going to see a number of, and maybe not just U.S. corporations, but you're going to see a number of corporations either move their headquarters there or set up entities there in order to avoid taxes, the same way that Ingersoll Rand and Nabors, the big oil drilling company, moved their headquarters on paper to Bermuda or Barbados. And all of this is part of an effort to avoid taxes. And that's why the idea of invading the Cayman Islands is, why do we allow these parasitic operations to damage us for their benefit? The damage they do is vastly greater than any benefit that they obtain in those countries.
Hmm. Do you sense change in the air over these major issues, David, or not?
Well, yes. The most crucial thing is people need to have a deeper understanding of these issues. That's why I wrote Free Lunch and the book Before It Perfectly Legal. And the article in Mother Jones, this issue called Fiscal Therapy, is to, so that people have a base of knowledge to understand what happened. One of the big concerns, though, is that, you know, we need to have not just, for example, a stimulus package right now for the economy. We need to also have reform. And yet I can tell you from listening yesterday to cable television shows that, beyond a doubt, Wall Street and the banking industry are already hard at work trying to make sure there is no real reform. The tax industry to make sure there is no real reform, because these people's livelihoods depend on the system damaging the country. It is absolutely perverse. And they are not going to just quietly say, oh, sure, this is what's best for America. Let's do this. They're going to fight tooth and nail. You know, Frederick Douglass famously said, you know, power grants nothing. Sure. You have to, if you want change, you have to fight for it. It isn't going to just happen.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Janine, for your call. Let's go to Daryl from Akure. Hi, Daryl.
Hello, Kathleen, and thank you so much for the program.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple comments. Thank you, sir. You prove an assumption I have had for some time now, and that is that the truth is uglier than the lies we have been told, especially over these last 8 years in particular. My hope is that we, the people who voted for change, will call or write our elected officials, our representatives and senators, and demand a change and demand unanswered questions be answered, even if investigations are needed, because I believe Mr. Obama already has enough on his plate with two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, the economic situation and environment, not to mention dealing with we the people. Thank you.
Thanks, Gerald. David?
Yep. Well, one of the things in free lunch that I promote heavily is the notion that we need to be involved in our government.
Mm-hmm.
Just as outsourcing jobs has been devastating to blue-collar America, outsourcing democracy mm-hmm. to the elites has been absolutely devastating to our country. And one of the things I recommend people do is, when on those rare occasions when your congressman or senator shows up to where people are going to be, get a group of people together. Come up with some tightly honed questions, not speeches, just questions. Go salt the audience and pop up and ask a question. And when the congressman or senator tries to evade it, have somebody else get up and say, wait a minute, you didn't answer the question. If this happens enough to our politicians, they will begin to detect that, wait a second, something's going on. Because one thing that's been true about politicians, whether it's in ancient Athens or America today, is they all get up in the morning, wet their finger, and hold it up to see which way the political wind is blowing.
Thanks for the call. We go next to Steve from Green Bay. Hi, Steve.
Hello. How are you doing today?
All right, Steve. How are you?
Pretty good. I've got a question that I heard on XM Radio about 2 years ago, and I heard that the wealthy only pay Social Security for the first $900,000 of their income, and then no more.
I thought it was...
Actually, they only pay it on the first this year. It'll be $106,000.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're an executive who makes $50 million, and there were at least 151 people who had a salary of more than $50 million in 2007, you only paid Social Security on your first 100, and that year I think it was $102,000.
Mm-hmm. David?
Hello?
Yeah, hi, David.
Hi, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, we can hear you fine. Are you having a problem hearing us?
No. I just
okay.
You got my answer about that. It was only on $100,000 or so.
No, I didn't hear you say that, but yes.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. The Social Security tax stops at a little over $100,000, not $900,000.
Right.
In 2007, there were 151 Americans whose salary exceeded $50 million. And those people only paid Social Security tax on the first, I think last year, it was 2007, was $102,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was on the basis of that, though, that the rich were in favor of Social Security, right? Wouldn't you have a hard time changing that now?
Well, there's a lot of discussion whether we should raise the Social Security level, but the discussion is about raising it to, say, $250,000 of salary.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we're going to do that, why don't we treat it like the Medicare tax and raise it all the way to the top?
Mm-hmm.
Make $50 million, we're going to tax your whole $50 million.
So why don't we?
because there's no political will to do it. Because if you're a member of Congress, your real constituency is not the voters. It is the campaign contributors and the bundlers. And once you're in office, and I've interviewed over 100 members of the House and the Senate about this, your time is spent primarily talking to representatives of wealthy people and large corporations. It's not worrying about you and me. It's worrying about their interests. And so just like when you're in love, you know, you sort of blinded to everything else in the world, and you're focused on that, that's what happens to members of Congress. They hear constantly, you know, no lobbyist comes in and says, we want you to give us this deal. They say, you know, we found this thing that just isn't fair, and we're just seeking fairness. Well, fairness done to the nth degree for those people who have access and who are campaign contributors is not fairness to the rest of us.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, you've been a fabulous guest. You know, we don't have your book yet. Can I ask you, or is this putting you too much on the spot? Will you join us during our pledge drive so we can?
Would you? Kathleen, I'd be delighted to.
Thank you, David.
And absolutely.
All right, wonderful. Because there's so much to talk about, and we'll get the book and read the book and talk about the book, and we'll talk to you during pledge. Thank you for all of your work, David. Thanks.
Thank you.
And in the meantime, we direct you to the Mother Jones article, and thanks to our listeners for suggesting this on our open line. Mother Jones, January-February issue, Fiscal Therapy is the name of the article. The book, and we'll talk to him about that, is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. It's available in paperback. We'll talk about that during our next pledge drive, huh? So we can make some money for public radio so we can have more money to be able to talk about these kinds of issues concerning money. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thank you, as always, for your wonderful phone calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Be with you again Monday morning at 9 for all things political. It's a minute before 11. Great conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.